Was the attack on Pearl Harbor really an unprecedented surprise attack? And also we've got the testimony of Mitsuo Fushida, who led the Pearl Harbor attack and how he was converted to Christ and became an evangelist later. Quite a story. Journalism has to look at the story behind the story and get the facts behind the headlines. Was the attack on Pearl Harbor really an unprecedented surprise? As my history teacher, Mr. Rhys Davies, in Rhodesia taught me, beware the victor's version. Wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. The claim that no one could have anticipated torpedo attacks in the shallow waters of a harbor before the 7th of December 1941 is false. The British had proved that torpedoes could be effective in the attack on the Italian Navy at Taranto, 11th of November 1940. The Royal Navy used Swordfish biplanes to deliver the torpedoes. On the night of the 11th to 12th November 1940, British Naval Force under Admiral Andrew Cunningham, including aircraft carrier HMS Illustrious, launched Fairey Swordfish biplane torpedo bombers in the Mediterranean Sea to attack the Regina Marina, the battle fleet at anchor of the Italian Empire in the harbor of Taranto. This was Mussolini's pride. It was a serious battle fleet, and they had tremendous potential. And so this is their battleship row and destroyers, cruisers in Taranto. Despite the shallow depth of the water, the aerial torpedoes proved devastatingly effective, crippling the Italian Navy, which lost half its capital ships in one night to these First World War-looking biplanes. Not very fast aircraft, but very effective for operating off an aircraft carrier and to be able to drop torpedoes in the harbor. And they crippled the Italian Navy in two sweeps. You can see the first wave was west to east. The second wave was north to south. And the Italians lost one battleship sunk, two battleships damaged and under repair for 6 to 8 months. One cruiser and two destroyers damaged, two planes destroyed, 59 people killed, 600 wounded. The British lost two planes, two airmen killed, two airmen captured. A very effective air raid, and that was just one aircraft carrier being used with very, very, very slow biplanes. And these are some of the pictures showing some of the devastation caused to the Italian Navy at Taranto. So the Royal Navy raid on Taranto Bay marked the ascendancy of air power over sea power. The fleet air arm proved to be the Royal Navy's most devastating weapon. And that was revolutionary. Most people up to that point said battleships will always beat aircraft. And so the attack on Taranto was an epoch event which has mostly been ignored in recent years. The US Navy had discussed this new threat seven, almost 8 months later, in June 1941, memorandum. And this attack had happened on the 11th of November 1940. So in June 1941, they considered a precautionary measure against torpedo plane attacks to put in torpedo nets in Pearl Harbor. Admiral Kimmel and his staff testified that the decision not to install torpedo nets and booms had been made by the Navy Department in Washington, D.C., not in Hawaii. Hawaii wanted the torpedo booms and nets, and Washington said, no, you're not to put them in. So was the Japanese raid on Pearl Harbor unprecedented? 17 months before Pearl Harbor, the British Royal Navy attacked the French fleet at anchor on the coast of French Algeria. The Battle of Meres El Kebir, 3rd of April, 1940, resulted in the deaths of 1,297 French servicemen, the sinking of a French battleship, the damaging of five other ships. The combined air and sea attack was carried out against Britain's ally, France. They were still allied to France. France was their main ally through the whole Second World War. And the French and the British were still fighting together at that moment. The attack remains controversial, put it nicely. It created a lot of hostility between France and Britain. Here's one of the memorial plaques to this attack. Britain argued that times were desperate, invasion seemed imminent, that's questionable. The British government simply could not afford to risk Germany seizing control of the French fleet. The prominent British motive was thus dire necessity and self-preservation, which sounds reasonable. However, the French insisted that as their terms of surrender with Germany did not require them handing over their fleet, they didn't have to hand over any of their fleet, which was still in French-controlled territory. The British action was considered treacherous. This is an interesting comparison, showing that France had far more submarines than Germany, that Britain had about as many submarines as Germany, which most people don't realize, that Germany's navy was minuscule compared to the Royal Navy and actually very small compared to the French Navy. The Royal Navy was hugely larger than the German Navy. The German Navy never even came to 20% the size. The Kriegsmarine was never 20% the size of the Royal Navy. If the German goal had been world domination, they would have needed aircraft carriers. Britain had 11 aircraft carriers at that moment. It says that Germany had one. That's not true. Germany had the crafts pre-planned, but they never built it. They never designed a plane that could land on or take off from an aircraft carrier. So effectively, Germany never had an aircraft carrier, even though one was in planning. One in planning, never launched. Considering that America had 13 aircraft carriers, considering that Japan had 12, that Britain had 11, and for that matter, France had 2 aircraft carriers, how are you going to have world domination if you don't have aircraft carriers? If you don't have battleships and a navy big enough to take on the American Navy, the British Navy, French Navy. If Germany really wanted to challenge Britain for world domination, then it would have gone a long way towards improving its chances of it taking the French Navy. That would have more than doubled the German Navy size, because the French Navy was much more than twice the size of the Kriegsmarine. But they never touched the French Navy. So that's an interesting point. The French ships that were in Alexandria, that's Egypt, believed they were allies of Britain, were shocked to be blockaded, boarded, and seized by the Royal Navy at the same time. Also on the 3rd of July, 1940, French ships in Plymouth and Portsmouth, England, were boarded and captured. This included the French submarine Surcouf, the largest submarine in the world at that time. 4 other submarines, the battleships Paris and Cobalt, destroyers Triumphant and Leopold. Some officers and sailors were killed in the struggles, and these attacks were justified by the Royal Navy because the British strategy of Copenhagen, the fleet. Copenhagen, of course, is the capital of Denmark. Admiral Horatio Nelson's famous Battle of Copenhagen, 2nd of April 1801, was a clear inspiration for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, 1941. In fact, what the Japanese did to the French Navy at Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December, 1941, was they Copenhagen the fleet. And that's the term everyone would have understood, because the British trained the Japanese Navy. Although Denmark was officially neutral during the Napoleonic Wars, Britain feared that Denmark's Navy may be seized by the French if Denmark fell to the French. It didn't, but if it did, maybe. So the Battle of Copenhagen was a result of multiple failures of diplomacy, to put it nicely, and with Britain enforcing a strict blockade of France and any country who was trading with France, even neutral countries like Denmark, Sweden, and Prussia were regarded as legitimate targets. Admiral Sir Hyde Parker and Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson led the attack on the Danish capital, Copenhagen, which, remember, was not a British enemy. Hadn't been a British enemy since back in the days of the Vikings. And you can see here the Danish flags and the British flag. This is the Copenhagen of the fleet. The British attack, during which Admiral Nelson famously placed his telescope to his blind eye. One of his eyes was blind, the other black patch over it. So turning a blind eye to a command or an issue is taken from the Copenhagen, the fleet of Admiral Horatio Nelson. He is ordered to disengage, and so he put the, very ostentatiously put the telescope to his blind eye, and his men were told to just carry on with what they were doing until they'd finished. And from the British perspective, the Copenhagen fleet was spectacularly successful. 1,600 Danish sailors and soldiers were killed or wounded. Most of the Danish navy was sunk, severely damaged, or captured. Remember, no declaration of war, not an enemy, not in a state of war, a peacetime action. Although ostensibly neutral, Denmark was again attacked by the Royal Navy on the 16th of August to the 5th of September in 1807, when the Royal Navy bombarded Copenhagen, seized the Danish fleet as a precaution in case Denmark did choose to join the French. She didn't, but just in case. And so this is some of the scenes of Copenhagen, which of course is the capital, you know, Hans Christian Andersen, Little Mermaid, all those books came out of Copenhagen, being bombarded. 3,000 soldiers and civilians. That's more than the amount of Americans who died in Pearl Harbor. 3,000 soldiers and civilians, including 195 children in Copenhagen, died as a result of the bombardment in 1807. Pretty sad. As the majority of the Danish army was at the southern border to protect against the possible attack from the French, this second assault on a neutral country was a scandal at that time. People didn't exactly think that Britain was being honorable in doing this, and this would have been well known at the time of 1941 during the attack on Pearl Harbor, because people were better informed on history at that stage. We've been bombarded with a very narrow selection of distortion from Hollywood and the news media, which is extremely narrow, and so our people are less informed about this, but most people would have been aware of these sorts of things, and Copenhagen the fleet was common terminology amongst naval people. Not just Royal Navy, but the Japanese Navy knew it because they'd been trained by the British and they were drilled in British naval doctrine. Knowing that the Imperial Japanese Navy was modeled on the Royal Navy, their uniforms, their rank structures, everything was modeled on the Royal Navy. These famous battle strategies and tactics of Copenhagen the fleets of even neutral countries where potential threat was perceived, including Britain's French allies, just the year before 1940, and most tellingly at the Battle of Taranto, when aircraft launched from an aircraft carrier using torpedoes had crippled a battle fleet. All of this should have been taken into consideration. The idea that these Americans were minding their own business under the palm trees, sunning themselves and surfing off Honolulu, oblivious to the fact that there could ever be an air attack or torpedoes used on ships in a harbor, or that you could be attacked before you even at war with a country and so on. There's no way that their leaders could have been that stupid or that uninformed. When you look at the navies of the different countries of the world, the German Navy, the Austrian Navy, the Italian, the French, the American, the British, oh, and the Japanese, right in the middle. And the Japanese looked like they dressed just the same as the British Navy for good reason. In fact, the British Navy's rank structure, as you see in the middle here, was exactly the same as the Japanese Navy's. And that's the way they operated, and that's exactly the terminology they used as well. This picture could be a Royal Navy picture, except it's a Japanese Navy. They look like the British Navy. They've got the British uniforms, they've got the British rank structures, they've got the British disciplines, even the way they blew the whistles and the trumpets and the bugles, and everything was Royal Navy. They'd been trained by them. And that's why the book, Old Friends, New Enemies, the Royal Navy and the Imperial Japanese Navy in the Pacific War, was a Royal Navy analysis of how the Japanese Navy, their old friend and the new enemy, behaved in this war. Warships of the Imperial Japanese Navy, in fact, don't their warships even look like the British Navy at the time? Very similar structure. Modern American films like Tora, Tora, Tora and Pearl Harbor tend to ignore these historic precedents and pretend that the attack on Pearl Harbor was both unprecedented and unexpected. They don't even mention Taranto or Copenhagen or anything like this. It's just like as though the U.S. Navy wasn't aware of it and wasn't considering this possibility. If they weren't, then they were terminally foolish and stupid. The first surprise attack by aircraft on ships I've read in history books. Generations have been deceived into thinking that Pearl Harbor was a treacherous, unexpected, unprecedented attack, a day that will live in infamy, to quote Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Admiral James Richardson was fired by President Roosevelt for complaining about the President's order to station the Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor. The Pacific Fleet was meant to be based in San Diego on Californian coast. And putting the entire fleet in Pearl Harbor was considered a highly reckless and threatening act. Admiral Richardson blamed the President, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, for the initial defeats in the Pacific as direct, real, and personal. Here he takes an oath before the Congressional Pearl Harbor investigation, blaming Franklin Delano Roosevelt for this political decision that led to this war and the defeat. Admiral Richardson believed that stationing the Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor made the ships extremely vulnerable to attack and provided poor, non-strategic defense. just look here. Notice this narrow opening to the sea. The entire British Pacific fleet was holed up in this place, and all they needed to do was sink one battleship in that entrance to the harbour, and they're all stuck. And what can they do? And they're just a turkey shoot inside here for any air attack. And remember, Japan had 12 aircraft carriers. So they knew that this was seriously important to Japan, aircraft carriers. So the fact that an aircraft carrier could, in very short order, cross that part of the Pacific, reach Pearl Harbor, and sink the Navy was a very real possibility. And if their naval strategic planners did not consider it, then they were incompetent and shouldn't have had the position. Captain L.F. Safford, U.S. Navy in charge of Communications Security Section of Naval Communications in Washington, testified before the Admiral Hart Board that on the 4th of December, 1941, we received definite information from two independent sources that Japan would attack the United States and Britain at 9 p.m. Washington time, 6 December 1941. We received positive information that Japan would declare war against the United States at a time to be specified thereafter. This information was positive and unmistakable and was made available to military intelligence virtually at the moment of its decoding. They had a decoding system called MAGIC, very similar to the British GCHQ, where they had the ability to read all codes of German naval, aerial, and army traffic from before the war. The Americans were able to read all Japanese code traffic from the early 1920s. And this is why fax machines were invented. Fax machines were specifically invented by the U.S. Navy to get Japanese script across the Pacific that they could be decoded through this means. And, of course, telex couldn't do it because telex depended on the kind of character script we've got in the alphabet, and Japanese doesn't have that. So they needed fax machines to be able to get Japanese script over that they could decode it. And that code was called MAGIC, and that was the whole ability to read their codes. And so they knew exactly what Japan was planning. They received the information at the same time as the Japanese commanders received. And therefore, they knew everything that the enemy was doing in the dispositions ahead of time. Finally, at 10:15 a.m. Washington time, 7 December 1941, we received positive information from Signal Intelligence Service, War Department, that Japanese declaration of war would be presented to the Secretary of State at 1 p.m. Washington time that date. When it was approximately 1 p.m. in Washington, it would be daybreak in Hawaii and approximately midnight in the Philippines, which indicated a surprise air raid in Pearl Harbor in about 3 hours. President Roosevelt had ample time to broadcast a warning. In fact, when you looked at it, because of the huge amount of time zones around, if there's going to be a dawn attack, which is most likely, the only place there could be a dawn attack at that time was Pearl Harbor. Couldn't be Philippines, that's too far away, that's midnight, who attacks at midnight? And so they knew where it was coming. And of course, that's why the American Navy had been sent to Pearl Harbor just a few months before for this very purpose, to provoke an attack. On December the 6th, 1941, a message to the Japanese delegation, Congress, a consulate in Washington, D.C., was intercepted, broken, and distributed by the Signal Intelligence Service, SIS. General Albert Wiedemeyer is quoted by Herbert Hoover, that's President Herbert Hoover, in his Freedom Betrayed book, as stating, "When on December the 6th, our intercepts told us the Japanese were going to attack somewhere the very next day, whether in the Central Pacific or to the south in the Philippines and Dutch East Indies, the President of the United States, as Commander-in-Chief of our military forces, could have gone on radio and broadcast to the wide world that he had irrefutable evidence of an immediate Japanese intention to strike. This would have alerted everyone from Singapore to Pearl Harbor. Even though inadequate in some cases to defend effectively, nevertheless, our forces would have been able to take a toll which would have blunted the Japanese attack. In Hawaii, the capital ships might have been moved out of the harbor, out of this congested harbor to sea, where Admiral Kimmel at least had the foresight to keep the far more vital aircraft carriers. At least Kimmel had the aircraft carriers out. No American aircraft carriers were damaged in the attack on Pearl Harbor because they weren't there. Interesting. Convenient. Furthermore, our carrier task force in the mid-Pacific might have attacked the Japanese task force when its planes were aloft. There are many possibilities which could have given our men a fighting chance." Now, this is not written by some conspiracy theorist. This is written by previous President Herbert Hoover, President of the United States, in his book Freedom Betrayed. An army inquiry conducted July to October 1944 condemned negligence by General Marshall, he was Chief of Staff of the U.S. Forces, and other senior officers for having prior knowledge of the attacks from the intercepts and for not having alerted the military commander at Pearl Harbor. Here's the USS California, damaged by the attack on Pearl Harbor, 7th December. Congress was not satisfied with the military investigations and reports, and from November 1945 to May 1946, that's after the war, the Congressional Pearl Harbor investigation, a minority report by Senate members of the committee, condemned the endeavor to throw as soft a light as possible on Washington. Washington's a term that just means the politicians, the government. The Roberts Commission report was so hasty, inconclusive, and incomplete, some witnesses were examined under oath, others were not. Much testimony was not even recorded, several records went missing, and most inadequate explanations were supplied. Army and Navy information indicated growing imminence of war was delivered to the highest authorities, including President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The fatal error of Washington was to undertake a world campaign and world responsibilities without first making provision for the security of the United States, which was their prime constitutional obligation. You would have thought the only obligation militarily of the United States government was to protect America. You would have thought. But that wasn't the way Franklin Delano Roosevelt thought. High Washington authorities did not communicate to Admiral Kimmel, who was in charge of the Navy at Pearl Harbor, and General Short, who was responsible for the military security at Pearl Harbor. They weren't given adequate information of diplomatic negotiations, of intercepted diplomatic intelligence, which, if communicated with them, would have informed them of the imminent menace of a Japanese attack in time for them to be fully alert and prepare for the defense of Pearl Harbor. They crucified this man. Admiral Kimmel was effectively fired for dereliction of duty, is what they called it, that he had not defended Pearl Harbor effectively and so on. And this was later investigated. In fact, an intelligence operative who had all the information went to his home years later and said, "We knew about the attack days before." This information was communicated to the President, Secretary of the Navy, Knox, and all that. And at this point, Kimmel went on a crusade for the rest of his life to vindicate his name, took this to court, took this to Congress, and was vindicated that he had been unjustly accused, unjustly destroyed in his career, unjustly blamed for everything, and that they had withheld critical evidence because they wanted him attacked and they wanted the Pacific Fleet sunk. The failure to perform the responsibilities indispensably essential to the defense of Pearl Harbor rests upon Franklin D. Roosevelt, Henry Simpson, Secretary of War, Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy, and General George C. Marshall, who was Chief of Staff of U.S. Forces. Now, this is all a quote from President Herbert Hoover in Freedom Betrayed. Here's the radiogram reporting the Pearl Harbor attack. Air raid on Pearl Harbor, this is no drill. George Morgenstern, in his book Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War, published in 1947, just 2 years after the war, wrote, "With absolute knowledge of war, they refused to communicate that knowledge clearly, unequivocally, and in time to the people in the field upon which the blow would fall. Pearl Harbor provided the American war party with a means of escaping dependence on a hesitant Congress in taking a reluctant people into war. Pearl Harbor was the first action of the acknowledged war and the last battle of the secret war, upon which the administration had long since embarked. The secret war was, they were really involved in aiding the Soviet Union to survive Operation Barbarossa with trillions of dollars of aid and weapons, of what the people in America thought was the arsenal for democracy. Americans were working around the clock to produce weapons that they thought were going to Britain or Australia, New Zealand, whatever, to fight for freedom. And they didn't know that the vast majority of these weapons were actually going to Stalin's Soviet Union to enable the Red Army to keep their people captive. The secret war was waged against nations which the leadership of this country had chosen as enemies months before they became formal enemies by declaration of war. The secret war. It was waged also by psychological means, by propaganda and deception against the American people. The people were told that acts which were equivalent to war were intended to keep the nation out of war. Lies, deception, all the way along. Constitutional process existed only to be circumvented, until finally the war-making party of Congress was reduced to the act of ratifying an accomplished act. Not much you can do once you've been attacked, such as happened at Pearl Harbor. But one needs to know to understand the backdrop to all this, which Herbert Hoover's giving here, is that after the First World War, and we discussed Versailles last week, after the First World War, there was a revolt in America, and they kicked all the Democrats out. The Republicans swept the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House, and they kicked the Democrats out, who led them into this pathetic war, worthless war, in which 116,000 Americans had died for nothing, except to expand the British and French and Japanese empires by a million square miles, and all in the name of the war to end all wars and war for democracy and all this other nonsense which they discovered was lies. Every one of the 14 points was betrayed by Woodrow Wilson. And so the Congress came in 1920, and the Senate and the White House, enacted the strongest laws possible to make it impossible for America to ever again get involved in Europe's wars, any foreign adventurism, no more weapons to belligerents during a war, no more support, no more secret, this, that, and the other. And so basically, what Franklin Delano Roosevelt was doing in a secret war in aiding the Soviet Union with trillions of dollars of aid and weaponry that was absolute, as the Soviets say, was critical to their survival. The Soviet historians say they could not have survived 1941's Operation Barbarossa without the American weaponry, which was absolutely critical, which they were receiving many months before Japan attacked Pearl Harbor and before America formally entered the war. America was already involved in the war, helping the Soviet Union, which nobody in Congress would have allowed. In fact, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his entire administration would have been jail time criminals for treason under the laws enacted in 1920 by the 21-22 by the elections of 1920, where they rejected America ever getting involved in one of these cursed foreign wars. And Roosevelt had to get Germany or Japan to attack them to be able to force his country into war, because they didn't want to go to war. And he provoked it. So Herbert Hoover declares in his book Freedom Betrayed, it can never be forgotten that three times during 1941, Japan made overtures for peace negotiation. America never made one proposal, unless a futile proposal, to the emperor a day before Pearl Harbor could be called peace. A peace could have been made in the Pacific that would have saved China from ravishment, that would have protected the American Pacific flank. If Roosevelt, that's Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was still determined to carry out his undeclared war with Germany until it provoked reprisals, that protection in the Pacific was the only sane course. In other words, why have a war on two fronts? If you're determined to fight in Europe, why provoke Japan into an attack and tie your people up in a war in the Pacific, and now you've got a war on two fronts? It would have limited our engagement in any case to the European theater. As a result of this policy, an undeclared war upon Japan, we suffered the greatest military defeat in our history with immeasurable consequences. Public opinion was overwhelmingly against our being involved in the war up to the day of Pearl Harbor. America came into World War I 33 months after its outbreak. By the way, do you notice this? Japan attacks Pearl Harbor and then declares war on the U.S. Notice this other article, Japan's reply to the U.S. is delivered 12 months before the bombing of Honolulu. So you've got two titles in contradiction of one another. One says the declaration of war came after the attack. The other says it came 12 months before the attack. So which is right? Well, we know which is right. They lie when they say they got the declaration of war after the bombing. Pearl Harbor might not have known they were at war, but Washington knew they were at war. They'd received the delegation, they'd received it. And of course, they knew about it the day before anyway, that the declaration of war was coming. But formal presentation of it was still before the bombing. By the way, the Japanese were intending to deliver the declaration of war an hour before the attack on Pearl Harbor began. But the American Secretary of State kept them waiting for an hour so that the declaration of war could only be delivered closer to the actual attack. And so he knew what they were there for, so he delayed them and told the Secretary to just keep them waiting outside longer. So it was all part of the game. America came into World War II 27 months after it started. The processes and the months of lag were the same. We're quoting still from President Herbert Hoover. The appeal to crusade for freedom, for independence of nations, for lasting peace, the same pictures of atrocities, the fanning of hate, and above all, the massive lies and stimulation of fear of invasion, they were all identical. First World War, Second World War, lies, 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 more lies, and the people realized it afterwards. But in World War II, the people believed much less of it, and they believed much more that they were being deliberately pushed into war. They dimly recognized they were being ground in the mills of power politics and the personal ambitions of men. The First World War had been conducted on the Allied side in the name of the peoples. This war was the name of Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt. At times, the whole political military scene seemed their personal property as it was. Again, as President Herbert Hoover speaking in Freedom Betrayed. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. In the First World War, still quoting from Herbert Hoover, our sons marched to war with flowers in their rifles, bands and cheering people on every platform. There were no bands, no flowers, and no cheers on the railway platforms to World War II. There was little singing of war ballads by soldiers or civilians, except at the urging of paid conductors of propaganda. The station platforms were staging for grieving and tears. The promises, the speeches, the propaganda filled the air as in World War I, but this time the people received it grimly and with little believing. Now that's not the way it's generally depicted to us today. The general thing is like the people are all gung-ho for it, but that's propaganda. The people in America knew we've been this way before. We were lied to then, we've probably been lied to now. And so it came. The stab in the back, treachery, and all that. Buy war bombs and work, fight, sacrifice. Remember Pearl Harbor, avenge December the 7th. And, notice, all people of Japanese ancestry rounded up, even if they were American citizens, put into concentration camps, kicked out of California. Even this is quite shameful. Person searching you while he's got a cigar in his mouth. Just low. Freedom Betrayed indicts Franklin Delano Roosevelt for instigating the Pacific War. His economic sanctions against Japan, his shunning of Japanese peace overtures sparked the Pearl Harbor attack and ultimately the U.S. atomic bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the act of unparalleled brutality in all of American history. Again, quoting from Herbert Hoover. President Herbert Hoover and Freedom Betrayed documents Franklin Delano Roosevelt's contemptuous refusal of Prime Minister Conyers' proposal for peace in the Pacific of September 1941 as a lost opportunity. In fact, he indicts Roosevelt of tons of lost opportunities. The acceptance of both these proposals was prayerfully urged by both the American and British ambassadors in Japan, who were the closest to it. And ambassador said, take it, these are good proposals. The terms Konyai proposed would have accomplished every American purpose, except possibly the return of Manchuria, and even this was thrown open to discussion. The cynic will recall that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was willing to provoke a great war on his flank over this remote question, and then he gave Manchuria and North Korea to the Russians. So to stop the Japanese, who were anti-communist, from having it, he provoked a ruinous war of years, dropped atom bombs, and then handed the whole area, including North Korea and the whole of Red China, over to the communists. What was Japan doing in China? Fighting the communists, opposing Stalin, ensuring that the communists didn't take hold of China. Just what Germany was trying to do in Europe. Prevent communism from taking over Europe. Defeat communism in its heartland. And America went to war and just so coincidentally destroyed the two main military forces fighting communism in Europe and in Asia. Notice, in American presidential campaign 1944, the facts were known to Republican candidate Thomas Dewey. He withheld his fire. In other words, he knew about the treachery at Pearl Harbor, but he chose during a time war not to bring out this because it might seem unpatriotic during a time of war to expose the treachery of his own government. It could have helped him win the election, but he played fair. He lost the election. Herbert Hoover documents in Freedom Betrayed that American military officials strongly urged FDR to accept the 3-month standstill agreement offered by the Emperor of Japan in November 1941. Japan was alarmed at the threat of the Soviet Union, which had vast forces in the area, and a 90-days delay could have kept war out of the Pacific. Secretary of War Stimson, in his diary, disclosed that Roosevelt and his officials were seeking for a method to stimulate, provoke an overt act of aggression from the Japanese. Here's just one example of civilians killed by a bomb dropped from a Japanese plane near Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December. There were many documents relating to Pearl Harbor which are still classified, have not yet been made public by the United States government. Many of these documents were destroyed during the war, which is actually illegal. Some of the public records of the United Kingdom containing Churchill's most secret wartime intelligence briefs have been marked as closed for 75 years. When a government closes their files for 75 years, it means they're covering up some mega lies. Because if it would show them to be honorable, decent, and all, they would be having it published. When a government marks their documents during a war secret, you know, for 75 years, for goodness sakes. Now, the Lusitania files were closed for 60 years. The Operation Keelhaul files were closed for 30 years. The betrayal of millions of Russian Ukrainians into the hands of Stalin at the end of the Second World War, where American British troops at bayonet point forced Russians, including women and children, across the river into the hands of the communists, and all of them were either murdered or placed into Stalin's concentration camps to be worked to death. Mothers threw their babies into the icy rivers rather than have them raised as atheists. How bad a situation is that? And the Allies took 3 million souls and forced them across into the hands of the communists. That was sealed for 30 years. That's sickening enough. That was called the last secret. Well, if files are sealed for 75 years, what on earth is that covering up? And that includes the sections dealing with events from November 1941 through March 1942. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, "In politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way." Now, interesting, it comes from him. So, is he wanting us to believe that Pearl Harbor happened by accident? He says, if it happened, it was planned that way. In Day of Deceit by Robert Stinnett, a memorandum prepared by Commander McCullen stated that a memorandum issued in the immediate pre-war period declared that only a direct attack on American interests would sway the American public. The American public was solidly anti-war. It would only, and so was the Congress. Only a direct attack on America would favor direct involvement in the European war. So Anderson and Secretary Knox, Secretary of the Navy, offered 8 specific plans to aggrieve the Japanese Empire. And here it is. "It is not believed that in the present state of political opinion, the United States government is capable of proclaiming war against Japan without more ado. It might barely be possible that vigorous action on our part might lead the Japanese to modify their attitude. Therefore, the following course of action is suggested. A. Make an arrangement with Britain for the use of British bases in the Pacific, particularly Singapore. B. Make an arrangement with Holland for the use of their base facilities and acquisition of supplies in Dutch East Indies." I mean, these are right there in Japan's face. C. Give all possible aid to the Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek. Actually, the aid went mostly to Mao Zedong, the communist leader. D. Send a division of long-range heavy cruisers to the Orient, Philippines, or Singapore. That's a high threat in Japanese backwaters. E. Send a division of submarines to the Orient. Well, what do you have submarines there for? Threaten to sink their ships. F. Keep the main strength of the U.S. fleet now in the Pacific in the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands. Move them from their headquarters in San Diego, in California, over smack in the middle of the Pacific, close striking distance, and like a red flag to a bull in the middle of the Pacific. G. Insist the Dutch refuse to grant Japanese demands of undue economic concessions, particularly oil. Japan didn't have any oil. If Japan couldn't get oil from Indonesia, it couldn't fly its planes, or fight against the communists in China and a whole lot of other things, or resist the Russians if the Soviets attack. H. Completely embargo all U.S. trade with Japan in collaboration with a similar embargo imposed by the British Empire. If the British blockade them, the Dutch blockade them, the French blockade them, Americans blockade them, where else could Japan get anything from? Japan doesn't have these raw materials that they need to survive or wage war. If by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better. At all events, we must be fully prepared to accept the threat of war. So, I mean, what is this? There's an 8-point plan to provoke Japan to attack America. This idea that America's just stunned, shocked, horrified, a day that'll live in infamy, the last thing anyone expected, who could have anticipated this? That's just so much eyewash and propaganda and acting, play acting. If by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better. This was classified until 1994. Why was it classified until 1994 if they didn't have something to hide? Jonathan Daniels, Roosevelt's administrative assistant at the time, Pearl Harbor, presented an eyewitness viewpoint. The blow was heavier than he had hoped it would necessarily be. Heavier than he had hoped it would necessarily be. Who's he? President Roosevelt. The blow at Pearl Harbor was heavier than he had hoped it would necessarily be. It had to be a heavy blow, but it was heavier than he had hoped it would be. But the risks paid off. Even the loss was worth the price. The loss was worth the price. This, published in 1941, Pearl Harbor Sunday, the end of an era. By the way, notice this. November the 30th. Kurusu bluntly warned nation ready for battle. Gets clearer. Japan may strike over weekend. This is November 1941. And this is the Hilu. This is Hawaiian newspapers. Should be ready for attack any time. Nation must be ready for battle. Japan may strike over the weekend. Tokyo desperate as talks collapse. Not America's desperate. Tokyo's desperate. They're trying to talk. This is the American newspapers. At the time, ahead of it. But don't worry, there's the football scores. No reasonably informed person can now believe that Japan made a villainous, unexpected attack on the United States. An attack was not only fully expected, but was actually desired. It is beyond doubt that President Roosevelt wanted to get his country into the war, but for political reasons was most anxious to ensure that the first act of hostility came from the other side. It's like a person shouting, screaming in your face, provoking you, coming up and coming up, hit me, come on, hit me, and you. And after a while, you hit him, and then, you know, that's exactly what he wanted. Now he's, it's totally just provoking. For which reason? He caused increasing pressure to be put on the Japanese to the point that no self-respecting nation could endure without resort to arms. Japan was meant by American president to attack the United States. And again, this is not some conspiracy theorist. This is President Herbert Hoover in his book, Freedom Betrayed. How clear is that? Mr. Oliver Littleton, the British Minister of Production, said in 1944, this is quoted by British historian Russell Grenfell, Main Fleet Singapore. Also quoted in Freedom Betrayed. Japan was provoked into attacking America's Pearl Harbor. It's a travesty of history to say the Americans are forced into war. The Americans wanted the war. Well, not the American people, not the American army, not the American navy, but the American government wanted the war. William Henry Chamberlain, in America's Second Crusade, wrote, "It is scarcely possible, in the light of this and many other known facts, to avoid the conclusion that the Roosevelt administration sought the war, which began at Pearl Harbor." It's what they wanted. The steps which made armed conflict inevitable would take months before the conflict broke out. So there is no doubt whatsoever this was a plan. And the U.S. government had started conscription way before. They had turned the American economy onto a war production footing way before. If you watch Pearl Harbor, you hear lies, 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 and more lies. For example, they have there that there's Franklin Delano Roosevelt saying, you know, our people are making refrigerators instead of tanks and warplanes and so on. That's rubbish. They stopped making refrigerators a long time ago. They were making tanks at that very time that they put those words in this fictional film, Pearl Harbor. They make it out that Franklin Delano Roosevelt is unwilling warrior, reluctant warrior. I mean, this is the narrative the Americans love, and every single one of their war narratives, it's a reluctant warrior. He didn't want to be forced into it, but he had absolutely no choice, like in the Patriot. The man's just compelled, he's standing up, speaking for peace, and he's forced in. And this is the way they try and depict Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that he's the reluctant warrior. Then Secretary of State Hull issued his foolish ultimatum, and we were defeated at Pearl Harbor. It was an ultimatum. Japan was given ultimatums. It wasn't that Japan was giving America ultimatums. America was giving Japan the ultimatums. By Roosevelt insisting that Chinese Premier Chiang Kai-shek include Mao Tse-tung's communists in a coalition government, and Roosevelt's secret agreement at Yalta to betray Mongolia and Manchuria and North Korea, to the Soviets, future generations were betrayed. People today in America are talking, I mean, I go to America and I get people saying, don't you think we should nuke North Korea? I say, no. And, but, you know, this is, look at, who gave North Korea to the communists? Who liberated North Korea and then ordered their general, Douglas MacArthur, to withdraw to the 38th parallel to hand North Korea back to the communists? America's done this over and over. It's America that created North Korea. Just like they talk about, oh, we've got to nuke Iran. Well, who betrayed America's best ally in the Middle East, the Shah of Iran, into the hands of the Ayatollah's crazy bull? Jimmy Carter. I mean, America makes these enemies. Then they whinge and whine and throw up their hands in horror, but they're the ones who created it. For good reason. It's good for business, actually. All of China was sacrificed to the communists in the years of President Truman at the insistence of his left-wing advisors and General George Marshall. The Second World War ended with 450 million Asiatic people, most of the people of China and North Korea, betrayed under communist dictatorship. Oh, we're not even talking about the 150 million Europeans betrayed under communist leadership through the Yalta Agreement in Europe. Herbert Hoover and Freedom Betrayed declared, I had warned the American people time and again against being involved before the war. He's not just someone who documented what happened afterwards. He was warning them beforehand, this is what's going to happen. If you get involved in this war, you're going to save the Soviet Union, expand communism, and destroy the two nations that are preventing communism from expanding. Japan and Germany are the two nations that are keeping communism down and are threatening communism in the heartland of the Soviet Union. America attacked Japan, in large part, to prevent Japan from fulfilling its treaty obligations of attacking the Soviet Union in support of Germany, from this, because the Soviet Union had to fight on two fronts. If they were forced to fight over in Siberia too, they'd never been able to manage. They barely managed as it was. In fact, without American aid and support, they never would have anyway. So the whole point of provoking a war with Japan made no sense whatsoever unless your top priority was to save the Soviet Union. So again, quoting from Herbert Hoover, I stated repeatedly, its only end would be to promote communism over the earth, that we would impoverish the United States and the whole world. The situation of the world today is my vindication. He testifies, the mess, when he wrote this, one-third of the world's population and one-third of the world's land surface was under the hands of communism. The Soviet Union or China, from Moscow and Peking, was reigning communism, oppressing people, and their terrorists were coming as far as the Congo, South Africa, Rhodesia, Mozambique, Angola. Thank you to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Truman for saving communism in the Soviet Union and Red China, and giving it to North Korea too. Roosevelt ignored the whole communist infiltration into his own administration. Much of it was to be exposed before his death. But of more importance, he ignored the whole international purpose of communism and its morals in international relations. Blind service to Stalin and the Soviet Union is the legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's America. Its purposes and methods, communism's purposes and methods, had been blatantly stated to the world ever since 1917. Its statements and books were widely distributed in the United States. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was not a communist, although his wife was. His leanings towards Stalin and blindness to communistic activities arose partly from his own leftist leaning and partly from the usefulness of the communists in support of his administration politically throughout its 13 years in office. The Communist Party USA supported Franklin Delano Roosevelt on every level. And of course, we look at another time at his instructions to assassinate the top American war hero of the Second World War, General Patton, and how they cooperated with the KGB or the NKVD at that time to bring it about. Proverbs 17:15 says, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike an abomination to the Lord. His leanings towards Stalin and the communists began with the recognition of Soviet Union immediately upon his taking office in 1933. Bear in mind, 1933 was when the Holodomor was taking place in the Ukraine. Millions of Ukrainians were being deprived of their homes, their farms, their lands, expropriation without compensation, being forcibly removed. Millions were dying of starvation. The Soviet Union had the biggest bloodstained track record. And the first act of Franklin Delano Roosevelt upon getting into office in 1933 was recognize the Soviet Union. Why? Why? What has this got to do with American freedom to give legitimacy to the Bolshevik mass murderers? During 15 years prior to recognition, Democratic and Republican administrations alike had barred any relations with the country, the Soviet Union, which had returned huge numbers of mankind to slavery, was constantly conspiring against the welfare of other peoples. They'd murdered the Tsar and his family. By recognition of the Soviet Union, Roosevelt gave the Soviet Union certain respectability in the family of nations, but also of importance. By that act, he had opened the door to communist penetration and conspiracies in the United States. The Communist Party USA openly campaigned and was treated like a legitimate, respectable agency. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. In Herbert Hoover's Freedom Betrayed, General Douglas MacArthur's views are reported. The whole Japanese war was a madman's desire to get the U.S. into war. The madman, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, this is quoting from General Douglas MacArthur, America's commander-in-chief of the Pacific Theater. General MacArthur was convinced that the financial sanctions in July 1941 were not only provocative, but Japan was bound to fight, even if it were suicide. Unless these economic sanctions could be removed, as the sanctions carried every penalty of war except killing and destruction, and no nation of dignity would take that for long. Douglas MacArthur knew Asia. He understood the Japanese. He'd been based in the Philippines. And he said, this war was provoked by America. General MacArthur said, Roosevelt could have made peace with Konyai, the Prime Minister of Japan, in September 1941. He could have obtained all American objectives in the Pacific and the freedom of China and probably Manchuria. Konyai was authorized by the Emperor to agree to complete withdrawal from China and from Manchuria if they'd accepted these peace plans. But there's callous indifference to the American army beleaguered in the Pacific. Again, we're still quoting from General MacArthur. I believe it was the desire of President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill that we get into the war, as they felt the Allies could not win without us. Who's the Allies? Soviet Union. They didn't care about Poland, that's for sure. They're meant to be allied to Poland, France, and Soviet Union, but the only one who really got any aid was the Soviet Union. Poland got no aid. Ever. In fact, Roosevelt, in the end, on the request of Roosevelt, organized the murder of General Sikorsky, the Polish commander-in-chief of the governments in exile in Gibraltar in 1943, because he was insisting on an international Red Cross investigation into the Catan massacre, which we've looked at other events. So, still quoting from General MacArthur, they felt the Allies could not win without us, and all efforts to cause the Germans to declare war on us had failed. Why did they provoke Japan to war? Because all their provocations against Germany had failed to bring Germany to war with America. They'd fired on their ships, they'd fired on their navy, they had done everything, they'd confiscated all German possessions and investments in America. They were aiding Britain with massive amount of aid, they were aiding Soviet Union with massive amount of aid. They'd done everything they could to provoke Germany to war. And Germany would not take the bait. So they had to try and provoke the Japanese, and they knew the Japanese were an honor culture, and they could not fail to respond to a threat to their honor. And so their whole culture was, you shame me. It's like a knight in the Middle Ages, if you slap the man in the face and throw down the gauntlet. I demand pistols at dawn, satisfaction, swords, whatever. They were honor-bound to fight. I mean, that was the culture. And, of course, the Japanese were samurai culture, very much like the knights of the Middle Ages. Honor-bound. You tell them to that they must fight for honor, they would do it. General MacArthur was bitter about President Roosevelt's starvation of supplies at a time when the whole fate of the South Pacific and the Allies in Asia was at stake. General MacArthur was the general in charge of the army on the Philippines, which America had taken during another unprovoked war back in 1898 when they had attacked Spain and stolen all of Spain's possessions all over, sunk the whole fleet and things like this. Another false flag operation we looked at another time. And so they had an American army, huge American army in the Philippines. Now, America's been attacked by Japan. That's the narrative. So you would have thought, why doesn't America put all of its attention to fighting Japan? But who cared about American soldiers dying of starvation, lack of medicines, and without ammunition in the Philippines? The most important priority is to save Uncle Stalin's Red Army, because the Operation Barbarossa is almost succeeding the German armies within 20 miles of Moscow. I mean, let's get our priorities straight here. Who cares about Americans It's the Soviet Union that needs aid. That's actually what was going on. That's what Herbert Hoover is saying. Bataan completely occupied by the Japanese, April 1942. April. That's 4-5 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor. But hey, they poured over the aid to the Soviet Union, but they couldn't give General MacArthur the bullets, bandages, and supplies he needed to maintain his position in the Philippines. And so the vast majority of General MacArthur's army in the Philippines died. Still quoting from General MacArthur, Roosevelt showed his vindictiveness in many ways. MacArthur also told Roosevelt peace could be made with the Japanese any time after the Philippines were taken. With their supporting legs cut off, they were beaten. If they didn't have the Philippines, then they didn't have access to the oil and the rubber of Malaya or of Dutch Indonesia, and therefore they couldn't continue to maintain a war footing. If we get the Philippines, we've cut them off from all the strategic materials they need to survive. They can't make steel, they can't get rubber, they can't make tires, they can't fly their planes. If we can get the Philippines, we cut Japan off from its essential supplies. Then you can negotiate peace. You don't need to fight anymore. He said Roosevelt was determined that General MacArthur should not command in the final movement on Japan. General MacArthur declared, "We would have avoided all the losses of the atomic bomb. Hundreds of thousands of lives lost. And the entry of Russia, the Soviet Union, into Manchuria, had the Japanese peace overtures been accepted in early 1945. General MacArthur told President Herbert Hoover in 1946, and this quotes in his book, "Truman's policies were enabling Russia to make a puppet state out of Manchuria, betraying all of China and Mongolia to communism." Which is exactly what happened. In September 1944, John Flynn, a member of the American First Committee, America First Committee, remember, was started by the Lindberghs, the man who first flew across the Atlantic unaided, Charles Lindbergh, and his father started the America First campaign. You might have recalled when Donald Trump started speaking about America First, there was huge paranoia and hysteria because America First was the name of the Lindbergh campaign to keep America out of the First World War and to keep America out of the Second World War. America First, that was the campaign name. And so there's a lot of people who went absolutely ballistic over that. I mean, it was like blasphemy. Because it was opposing New World Order globalist wars to save communists from getting what they deserve. Rear Admiral Frank Beatty, who at the time was Pearl Harbor attack, was an aide to Secretary of Navy Frank Knox, testified, "Prior to December the 7th, it was evident, even to me, that we were pushing Japan into a corner. A New Dealer's War. FDR and the war within World War II. There's so much behind the scenes. The conditions we imposed upon Japan were so severe that we knew the nation could not accept them. We were forcing her so severely that we could have known that she would react towards the United States. That was the intention. All the preparations in a military way, and we knew their overall import, pointed that way." What does he mean, we knew their overall import? You can't say it at this stage because it's still secret, but we're reading all their decrypts. We knew everything that they were saying. We'd broken their code. They called it purple. Purple was the code for the Navy. Jonathan Daniels, Roosevelt's administrative assistant at Tom Pearl Harbor, said the blow that he had hoped it would be was heavier, but the risks paid off. Even the loss was worth the price. I mean, what kind of treacherous person says that about the deaths of thousands of their own people, including civilians? It is an abomination for kings to commit wickedness, for a throne is established by righteousness. Franklin Delano Roosevelt must rate as one of the very worst presidents in America's history. They've had some pretty bad presidents, from Lincoln, Carter, Obama, Clinton. I mean, there's some pretty bad ones. But when I made a comment at a meeting of Summit Ministries in the presence of David Noblet, when someone had just said Obama's the worst president in America's history, I said, well, think about Jimmy Carter. He betrayed 13 countries to communism, including Rhodesia and Nicaragua. And he betrayed the Shah of Iran into the hands of Ayatollahs. And that is still with us. We still have Mugabe, Zimbabwe. We still have the Ayatollahs in Iran causing trouble. And that's the legacy of 4 years of Jimmy Carter. And as I was saying this, David Noble put his hand on my shoulder. And he said, Peter, you're wrong. when it comes to damage done, nobody could exceed what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did. He betrayed one-third the world's land population, land surface and population into the hands of communism. And there was a silence in the room. I mean, this is an American speaking. And then someone from the back of the hall shouted, "And it all began with Lincoln." That's true. General George Patton said, "Politicians are the lowest form of life on earth. And liberal Democrats are the lowest form of politicians." He should know. Herbert Hoover observed, "Despite these physical losses and these moral political disasters and these international follies, despite the drift to collectivism, despite degeneration in government, despite the demagogic intellectuals, despite the corruption in our government and the moral corruptions of our people, we still hold to Christianity. We still have the old ingenuity in our scientific and industrial progress. We have 35 million children marching through our schools and 2.5 million in our institutes of higher learning. The promise of a greater America abides in the millions of cottages throughout the land where men and women are still resolute in freedom. In their hearts, the spirit of America still lives. The boys and girls from those homes will someday throw off these disasters and frustrations and will recreate their America again." So he ends this book with a vision of victory and with great hope and prayer. Forewarned is forearmed. In order to anticipate problems and threats in the future, we need to study the past. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. If we do not know our own history, we'll simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifice, and absurdities all over again, said Solzhenitsyn. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they're written for our admonition. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Truth does not fear investigation. Amos 5 verse 15 says, "Hate evil, love good, establish justice and negate." This is what we should aim for. Now, what I've given is pretty depressing. So let me conclude with something super positive and uplifting. Mitsuo Fushida and his Test Me from Pearl Harbor to Calvary. Mitsuo Fushida is best known for leading the devastating air attack on Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December 1941. After the war, Fushida became a Christian evangelist who conducted evangelistic outreaches throughout Japan, the United States, and Europe. Fushida was the son of the master of a primary school in Kashiwara. His grandfather was a samurai warrior. In many ways, he was a samurai warrior too, but in the air. Mitsuo Fushida entered the Imperial Japanese Naval Academy in 1921. He graduated as a midshipman in 1924, promoted to ensign 1925, sub-lieutenant 1927. By the way, you notice these are all British naval designations and ranks. He specialized in horizontal bombing. He gained combat experience during the Sino, or Chinese-Japanese War, where he was assigned to the aircraft carrier Kaga in 1929. Promoted to lieutenant commander in 1936, he was accepted to the Naval Staff College, which is where you train to go into higher ranks. He joined the aircraft carrier Akagai in 1939 as commander of the air group. By the way, he traveled to Europe, and he observed some of the Battle of Britain. He flew in Messerschmitts and observed the differences between German Messerschmitts and British Spitfires and so on. He was made commander in October 1941 under the command of Vice Admiral Nagoma, with six aircraft carriers and 423 aircraft under him. Commander Fushida was responsible for the coordination of the aerial attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Now, if you've seen Toya, 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 or Tora, 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 it's spelt us, but Japanese pronounce it Toya, Toya, Toya. These are the people who play, and in fact, the person concerned looks very much like Mitsuo Fushida. And he was, by the way, an expert advisor on the film set for Toya, Toya, Toya. This is quite a phenomenal operation. Direct line from Japan to Honolulu, but they went way north and came down from the north. This was the target. The entire American Pacific Fleet bottled up in this turkey shoot. Now, these are some of the Japanese sketches. You can see how they're crossing out, like, you know, two lines being damaged and three lines pretty serious. X, like, sunk, and so on. So these are obviously their different ways of trying understanding And this is what he is circling the whole time during the battle. And these are his notes on the attack as the commander. He was in the first wave of 183 dive bombers, torpedo bombers, and level bombers and fighters, which took off from carriers 370 kilometers north of Ohio and targeted the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. One of the bombers, these are pictures taken actually at the time of the attack by the Japanese. At 7:40 a.m. Hawaiian Standard Time, Fuchida ordered Tenkai take attack position. He slid back the canopy of the Nakajima Kate torpedo bomb and fired a green flare to signal attack. He then instructed his radio operator to send a coded signal, top, 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 strike. And this was the result. These are pictures taken actually at the attack. At 7:53, Fuchida sent the code words, Toya, 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 back to the carrier Akagai, the flagship, to report complete surprise had been achieved. Tora, or Toya in Japanese, was the acronym for Tusageki Rakageki, torpedo attack. In Japanese, the acronym TO and RA together, Tora, actually means tiger. And tiger achieves complete surprise. You may not see the tiger in the jungle, but he'll see you. First thing you'll know about is when he's got you. So tiger was using the acronym of torpedo attack, but to mean we've achieved complete surprise. When the attack on Pearl Harbor hit at 7:55 a.m., many American sailors or soldiers were on leave or sleeping late. That's Sunday morning. Why were they not in church, just for starters? I mean, I'm just wondering, what on earth is the case for these people? Seven battleships are lined up on Battleship Row. And here you can actually see, these are actual pictures taken by the Japanese during the attack. And you can see naming, identifying. And here's a Japanese aerial photograph of the Battleship Row under attack. And you can see the oil spreading out from torpedo attacks. And I mean, the billowing smoke. And you can just begin to imagine some of the horror going on underneath there. The Oklahoma capsized. The West Virginia and California were sunk. The Nevada was damaged. Beach near the mouth of Pearl Harbor. If it had sunk in the mouth, that should have been bottled up the whole fleet. Tennessee, Maryland, and Pennsylvania were damaged. 10 other ships are sunk or seriously damaged. The Arizona sank with over 1,000 sailors on board after a stupendous explosion of its forward magazine to one dive bomber. Bomb went straight through the deck into its magazine. That was the worst. Just 8 days later, the Americans had published a picture of this same ship, the Arizona, with the words, "It is significant that despite the claims of air enthusiasts, no battleship has yet been sunk by bombs." Might have been sunk by torpedoes, but not by bombs. And pride goes before a fall. It's like people saying, not even God could sink the Titanic. It's a pretty dumb comment to make. As the first wave returned to the carriers, Fuchida remained over the target to assess damage to observe the second wave attack. He returned to his carrier only after the second wave had completed its mission. 21 large flak holes, that's from anti-aircraft guns, were found in his aircraft. The main control wires were barely holding together. It's incredible that he could have survived so many hits to his aircraft. He stayed over the combat zone the whole time of the attack during two waves. He actually shouldn't have made it back to the ship. 21 hits? How does a plane like that stay? I mean, have you seen them? These planes are mostly canvas and string and wire. The Japanese lost 29 aircraft in the attack on Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Pacific Fleet lost 21 ships, including almost every battleship, 188 aircraft destroyed, another 159 damaged, 2,403 lives lost. Absolute disaster in Pearl Harbor. And these are just some of the pictures of the devastation and destruction caused. In Fuchida's memoirs, he remarks being upset by Admiral Nagumo cancelling the third wave attack, which could have destroyed Pearl Harbor's fuel tanks and dry dock facilities, which would be needed to repair their ships. I was upset and thought, what stupidity. But the decision belonged to the commander, and it would not do any good if I complained. Not in Japanese culture, you didn't complain. But the third wave was planned, and the third wave was cancelled. And if the third wave had gone on, it would have been even more catastrophic. Years later, Fuchida said that while he mourned those who died aboard the USS Arizona and other ships, he didn't regret his role in the Pearl Harbor attack. It was war, he said. And remember, Japan was fighting for their life against communist China. They were trying to prepare to protect themselves against the Soviet Union. And now America was forcing them into a situation where they were being strangled to death, that they couldn't defend themselves, and they saw it need. They had to cripple the U.S. fleet so that they could take the oil and rubber that they needed in the Dutch, Indonesian areas and Malaya, and in this way be able to survive. They saw it as, well, we've been forced, that we've got no choice. So from his perspective, remember, he's not a Christian at this stage. He's a Shinto. He's from a Buddhist background. He worships the emperor, and he accepted the war culture. So his view was, well, we were at war, and we've been provoked to war, and the Americans must have known we were going to attack, because that, what else were they provoking us for? And he was granted an audience with the emperor. Tremendous. I mean, what an honor in that culture. The emperor is considered a living god to the Shintos, and his word was law, and they were all sworn to die for the emperor anyway. And the emperor personally decorates him with great and the highest medal that he could receive. On the 19th of February 1942, Fushida led the first of two waves, 188 aircrafts, in air raid on Darwin, Australia. Any country that has a city named after Darwin kind of is asking for something. On the 5th of April, he led another series of air attacks against the Royal Navy bases in Ceylon. And here's actually a picture of Mitsuya Fushida landing in a B-5N2 bomber on board the Akagi, one in the Indian Ocean, during the attack on Ceylon, 5 to 9 April 1942. In June 1942, Fushida was recovering from an emergency shipboard appendectomy. It had appendicitis. When he was wounded in the Battle of Midway, I mean, this was the key battle of the war on the Pacific. He was on the ship's bridge during the morning attacks by U.S. aircraft. As the Kagawa was hit, a chain reaction from burning fuel and live bombs began the destruction of the ship. An explosion threw him to deck. He broke his ankle. He's actually blown overboard and was in the sea, and he somehow survived. After recuperation, Fushida spent the rest of the war as a staff officer. 2 weeks before the American invasion of Guam, he was ordered to Tokyo. And when the Japanese on Guam failed to repel the American invasion, Vice Admiral Kakuta and his staff chose seppuku, the samurai ritual suicide of disembowelment, which, if he was on there and his leader ordered it, then they would have all had to commit suicide. That was just, he wouldn't have had a choice. And he says, again, the sword of death had missed me only by inches. What did it mean? The day before the first atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, he was in that city, in Hiroshima, to a teleconference. And a long-distance call from naval headquarters required him to return to Tokyo. As he ate breakfast in Yamamoto, 200 kilometers away, he learned that everyone he had been working with in Hiroshima had perished in the atomic explosion. The day of the atomic explosion, he was sent back to Hiroshima to assess the damage. I mean, nobody knew what an atomic bomb was. What was this? All the members of Fushida's party died of radiation. But Fushida exhibited no symptoms, never suffered ill effects, despite being exposed to exactly the same radiation everyone else was. Each of the officers who had accompanied Fushida to investigate the destruction of Hiroshima showed strange signs of illness. One by one, they died through what now we know to be radiation poisoning, but they didn't know that then. As Fushida returned to Kashiwahara, where he'd been brought up, to help his wife raise the children and to become now a farmer, he was depressed. Life had no taste or meaning. I'd missed death so many times. And for what? What did it all mean? After war, Fushida was called to testify at the trials of Japanese military leaders. When General Douglas MacArthur summoned Fushida to testify on the Tokyo war crime trials, Captain Fushida was disgusted and declared everyone should know that war is war and that cruel acts had occurred on both sides. But these were victors' justice. The General Tojo, who was the Prime Minister of Japan during the war, was put on trial for his life and was hung, not even given a soldier's death of firing squad, which he had requested. The petty vindictiveness of the Allies infuriated Mitsuya Fushida, and he denounced the victor's justice. In 1947, he met his former flight engineer, Kazuo Kenegasi, who he thought had died in the Battle of Midway, but had been taken prisoner. Kenegasi reported that a young Christian woman, Peggy Covell, had cared for them in the prison camps despite her missionary parents having been killed by Japanese soldiers on the island of Panay in the Philippines. Peggy Covell's parents were missionary teachers in Japan until 1939, They then relocated to the Philippines because there was a lot of anger brewing against America's, their policies. So they thought it was better to get out of the country. So they were in the Philippines in 1941 when they were invaded. The Japanese had beheaded both of Peggy's parents on Sunday morning, 19th December 1943. To Fashida, this love for one's enemies was inexplicable because in the Bushido code, the samurai code, it required revenge against the murder of one's parents to restore honor. So he became obsessed to try to understand why anyone would treat the enemies with kindness and forgiveness, which was against his war code. The extraordinary example of Peggy Covell and Jacob de Chazza inspired Fashida to know more about the God of the Christians. When Japanese prisoners of war asked the 18-year-old Peggy Covell why she volunteered to help them, her reply was, "Because Japanese soldiers killed my parents." When Peggy considered her parents' sacrificial service for the kingdom of God and their love for Japanese people, she is convinced she must continue their mission by seeking to reach Japanese for Christ. As Fashida researched from every source in the Philippines that knew the Covells, he learned they'd been forced to their knees by the captives. They'd prayed together as they were about to be beheaded, and they had prayed for the Japanese. They weren't praying for themselves. In 1948, as Fashida was passing by the bronze statue of Hachiko at the Shibuya station, this is this famous loyal dog who every day met his master at the railway station, and when his master died of a heart attack at the college where he's lecturing in town, and he didn't return, this dog waited there for years. He was there every night at the same time to wait for him, and he died there. So they built a statue for him. He was handed a pamphlet about the life of Jacob de Chazza, a member of the Doolittle Raid, who was captured when his B-25 bomber ran out of fuel and occupied China. The Doolittle Raid. In the pamphlet, "I was a prisoner of Japan. De Chazza, a former U.S. Air Force staff officer and a bombardier, related his testimony of imprisonment, torture, and awakening to God. Jacob de Chazza was the bombardier of the B-25 number 16, and after taking off from the USS Hornet, which in the Pearl Harbor film, they have fighter pilots suddenly being converted to fly bombers off an aircraft carrier. For goodness sakes, that is impossible. I suppose the movie wanted to kind of have a continuity, but you don't get fighter pilots being transferred to bomber. It's totally different. Fighters and bombers are not the same. It's just like in the Four Feathers, where suddenly you have cavalry officers becoming Camel Corps and then commanding infantry. Doesn't happen. I mean, it's just absolutely beyond comprehension. But anyway, so Jacob de Chazza was a bombardier in a bomber plane. He flew the bomber planes off. But, of course, in the Pearl Harbor film, they have a bunch of fighter pilots suddenly recruited to fly bombers off an aircraft carrier. Like, you can just make that conversion within a few moments. They flew to China, ran out of fuel over Japanese-controlled China. Now, this is this classic first time ever that twin-engined bombers were flown off aircraft carrier, but they needed the extra fuel to be able to bomb Japan as a retaliation for Pearl Harbor. Specific order from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He wanted a symbolic attack. He knew that there wasn't enough fuel for these poor people to return. They couldn't return. They just had to fly into China, and well, most of them would be captured anyway. But Roosevelt made his point that he wanted to make. And so the Doolittle Raid was basically a suicide bombing raid, because there was no way back. They couldn't be recovered. Nobody, you might be able to take these planes off, but you could never land them on the aircraft carrier. So there's nowhere to go except China. And most of China was basically, if it wasn't in the hands of communists, in the hands of Japanese, neither of which would have been a happy conclusion. So this was quite an operation, and it surprised the Japanese. It didn't do that much damage, but it was more of a morale propaganda benefit. So brave men are doing this, and here you can see Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle. Remember him, because later you'll see Matsuo Fashida with him, aboard the USS Hornet, April 1942. This is the American counterattack. Yeah, not many planes, but still, it made a point. And so you can see the Hornet launches, they bomb Japan, and they go and land in China. There's nowhere else to go. And these are some of the men in China afterwards, the few that escaped imprisonment. But de Chazza and his crew were captured after parachuting to the ground. De Chazza was imprisoned for 40 months. 34 of these months in solitary confinement, he is beaten, malnourished. He saw three of his crew executed by firing squad. The fourth member, Lieutenant Bob Medder, died of starvation. But after 25 months of hating his captives, a Bible came into his hands for only 3 weeks, but it changed his life completely. He began to learn Japanese and to treat his captives with respect. He resolved to bring the message of Christ to Japan. And after returning to the USA, De Shazer attended Seattle Pacific College and returned to Japan to preach the gospel. After 40 months as captives, three of the four surviving American prisoners noticeably emaciated. Here you can see the pictures. Arrived at Changking, China, late August 1945. Jake De Shazer on the far left. And here's De Shazer, now missionary, preaching in Japan. In fact, he went back and preached in the very towns he bombed. He established a church in Nagoya, the very city it bombed years before. Now, Fushida became intrigued with the Christian faith. The shocking examples of Christians able to forgive their enemies staggered Fushida. That's when I met Jesus. Looking back, I can see now that the Lord had laid his hand upon me so that I might serve him. Fushida read a tract on the spot right by the statue of this courageous, loyal dog. And on the train, he saw an advertisement for a book with the same title. This book, The Amazing Story of De Shazer, of course, in Japanese. He headed for a bookstore and he purchased it. De Shazer's story engrossed Fushida. He's also an airman. He could relate. Determined to understand what had motivated De Shazer, he bought a Bible from a Japanese man on the street at the same Shibuya station where he had received the pamphlet by that statue of the dog. 1949, he purchased that Bible. And as he read the gospel, he came to understand the reason for the life of forgiveness and mercy that had motivated both Peggy Covell and Jacob De Shazer. When he read, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing," Fushida realized this was what the Covells had been praying before their execution. It was the crucifixion of Jesus, words in the gospel, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing." It was on the 14th of April, 1950, that he surrendered to Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. By the time he had completed reading the Gospel of Luke, he had become a Christian. He knew no Christians, but now he began to declare himself to be a Christian. He didn't know of any other Japanese Christians. As Christianity was considered the occupation religion in Japan, it was considered a disgrace to his former family and friends who regard him with reproach. "You've accepted the enemy's religion." Peach and Glenn Wagner of the Pocket Testament League of Japan met with Fushida and encouraged him to join them in an open-air preaching. And here is an open-air preaching in Japan. In the business sector of Osaka, as the Americans stood to speak, fewer than 40 Japanese would stop to listen. But when Fushida, the hero of Pearl Harbor, was introduced, the crowd swelled rapidly. Rush hour traffic stopped, hundreds gathered, even the police listened in. This was the beginning of Fushida's new career as an evangelist. Soon he filled an auditorium in Osaka. 500 Japanese came forward at that rally. And every newspaper in Japan reported on it. He described his conversion as like having the sun rise, which of course is, that's the symbol of their flag. He preached against Japanese egocentrism and xenophobia. Like Paul on Mars Hill, he used Japanese cultural examples to communicate the gospel of Christ. Captain Fushida went from being a vital part of Japan's military attack in the United States to being a vital part of God's missionary offensive into the hearts, minds, and souls of Japanese, and later Americans and Europeans too. In May 1950, Fushida and De Shazer met for the first time. Jacob De Shazer and Captain Fushida in Japan. He knocked on his door and said, "I've desired to meet you, Mr. De Shazer. My name is Mitsuo Fushida." And De Shazer recognized the name immediately and said, "Come in, come in." And the former enemies embraced as brothers in Christ. Lifelong friends for then on. De Shazer and Fushida, they described one another as best friends. In 1951, Fushida published an account of the Battle of Midway. In 1952, he toured the United States as a member of the Worldwide Christian Missionary Army of Sky Pilots. Sounds like an interesting operation. I remember the thrill that was mine when in one of my first meetings I led my first soul to Christ in America. And he was one of my own countrymen. And here, being welcomed to the United States. Fushida in the middle there. Mitsuo Fushida And Admiral Harp, Chief Chaplain of the U.S. Navy, Reverend Sachs of the Sky Pilots of America. And here's Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle congratulating him on his meeting and greeting his former enemy. Doolittle, who bombed Japan in 1942, Bushido bombed Hawaii in 1941. How could this happen outside of Christ? Cliff Barrows, song leader of the Billy Graham evangelistic team, meeting Captain Fashida. George Wilson of Youth for Christ, presenting him with the Billy Graham Bible. Even Billy Graham, who's a tall man anyway, receiving him in 1942. This is an interesting... this is his signature in Japanese with a scripture. In February 1954, Reader's Digest published Fushida's story of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Fushida wrote, "From Pearl Harbor to Golgotha," later renamed from Pearl Harbor to Calvary, which we actually have in our shop. In 1955, expansion of his book, Midway, The Battle That Doomed Japan, The Japanese Navy Story, his autobiography, For That One Day, The Memoirs of Matsuya Fushida, Commander of the Attack on Pearl Harbor, was published in Japan 2007, translated in English, published in 2011. There's a lot more to his life than what I've mentioned. He was crash-landed in Borneo, walked for days in the jungle, and after 3 days walking in the jungle, every night tying themselves in trees to keep away from animals, they came back to a shot-down plane and saw, oh, it's our plane. They've been walking in circles for the first 3 days. They just about all lay down on the ground and lost all hope of anything. But how they finally found their way out, and so many different experiences that this man went through. It's said that the reason for a state to nurture its soldiers for years is to use them for just one day. My entire youth was dedicated for that one day. All his training, all the character development, discipline, so on, focused for that one day, the day of battle. In Midway, The Battle That Doomed Japan, Fushida wrote, 5 minutes. Who would have believed that the tide of battle would shift in that brief interval of time? And if you know how it went, the backwards and forwards, this is the first battle where navies, where they never saw one of them. The ships were never in sight of one another. It was all fought by aircraft. And just the coincidences and the amount of extraordinary things that happened. You'd have to see the film Midway to kind of understand how it was by a thread. There was just, the Japanese had more aircraft carriers, they had more planes, and they had more experienced pilots. But their one plane, spotter plane that went out, that sighted the American fleet that was waiting to ambush them, because the Americans, of course, knew their plans ahead of time, their radio wasn't working. So they weren't able to alert the... The Japanese made some key tactical decisions which shifted against them. And at a key point, one off the other of the American torpedo planes, dive bombers and others came one off the other, and they were all shot down, every one of them. They lost fleets of their aircraft, squadrons attacked the ships. And at a key point, when the Japanese had sunk one of the American ships, or they thought they had, actually it was only partly sunk, and seriously damaged. And they thought they had gotten all American planes that attacked them. But all their planes were down on the ground chasing others. But their combat air patrol over. They were all down. At that point, one more American dive bomber squadron came in, the last. And there was no Japanese combat air patrol in the air to protect their ships. And all their ships were full of the planes that had just come back from the attack on Midway. That were needing to be refueled, and the other ones that had the bombs already to take off for an attack on Midway, and were all stuck on the aircraft carriers at the same time, and then in came the dive bomber squadron. They were caught flat-footed at a key moment. We have been caught flat-footed in the most vulnerable position possible, decks loaded with planes, armed and fueled for attack. And the Battle of Midway could have gone the other way so easily. But the Japanese lost 4 aircraft carriers. And incredibly, Fushida survived, even in a doomed aircraft carrier that was sunk. And he still survived. Fushida turned down offer from the Japanese government to organize the new Air Force. He faced down angry Pilate, pulled a knife and threatened to kill him, although that man later came to Christ. Here is at Pearl Harbor 1966, pointing to where he led the Japanese planes. He ministered in prisons. He led people to Christ, even in cells of condemned prisoners. He formed Calvary clubs in prisons. Mashiach Fushida related the testimony of Peggy Covell and her brave parents all over Japan. He quoted a testimony, "But the Holy Spirit has washed away my hatred and has replaced it with love." The Covells had gone to death singing hymns joyfully and praying for the conversion of enemies. The blood of the martyrs is a seed of the church, and Mashiach Fushida was one of the fruits of their faith, of the Covells' faith. Fushida spent the rest of his life as an evangelist, taking the gospel of Christ throughout Japan, United States, America, and Europe. You can actually even Google and get some videos of him being interviewed on American TV. You might have seen the film Tora, 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 which is the most accurate Pearl Harbor film. It's painstakingly accurate with the testimony that were given. Of course, they weren't allowed to use the details that we knew all the codes ahead of time that much, but they allude to it. His testimony for that one day. And there's a whole range of interesting books on it. And this, I've actually got the, this came in one of our shipments. This is one of the original ones, and this is the new reprint, which we've got in the bookshop. But there's a lot more pictures in this one. I've shown the pictures from this in this presentation. From Pearl Harbor to Calvary. We should pray for Japan. In fact, I did this study a few years ago, in 2015, because my son Calvin was in the Scouts, and they were going for their Jamboree, which is only every 4 years, a major, major event for all the Scouts around the world get together, and you only get one chance as a Scout to go to a Jamboree. And this was Calvin's chance. It was going to be in Japan, and I got suspicious about the time, because why was it in August? And I knew immediately, it's 70th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And I was angry, because I thought, they're going to use them for some anti-American propaganda and so on and so forth. So I decided to investigate into, you know, bombing on Pearl Harbor, which I'd always assumed was totally essential to end the Second World War and so on. But I believed that propaganda, and when I studied it, found that every single American military leader at the time, including General MacArthur, said it totally wasn't necessary and was in fact a war crime and unacceptable and so on. And came to the conclusion, as Herbert Hoover puts too, that the atom bombs were not dropped on Japan to end the Second World War, but to start the Cold War. Because the Second World War was coming to an end. The Japanese wanted to end it months before. But it was essential to start a new paranoia that would justify even more war spending, even when the war's over. And these military-industrial complex criminals and banksters made even more money out of the Cold War than they made out of the First and Second World War combined. And that the atom bombs had a different purpose. Well, in doing more investigation, Father Fushida's testimony and made it into a tract, which we've got in the hallway, for my son to take to Japan when he went on the outreach there and to distribute to the other scouts something significant about Japan. And that's where that testimony came from. And then just going a bit further into Herbert Hoover's book, I realized, goodness me. But even this whole Pearl Harbor attack, this day of infamy, this treacherous backstab was complete fabrication and propaganda. There's a lot of books that have been absorbed into these presentations, but these are just some of the research that's out there. There's a huge one. In fact, I was interested just the other night to listen to the testimony of Admiral Kimmel's grandson, speaking on Andrew Carrington Hitchcock's radio program. And Admiral Kimmel's grandson speaking about that he had heard from his dad, his grandfather. He had got the whole story from him, and how he himself has entered the Navy too, and was friends with General Short's grandson as well, who'd also entered the army, and how determined they were to clear their grandparents' name. And all the investigation that exposed this treachery of the U.S. government and the FDR. So, in fact, I think real history is far more fascinating than the propaganda and the garbage that we get dished up in Hollywood. So, any questions, any comments?
That after the First World War, the Americans had cleared out all the leftists. but then Second World War, boom, they were back again. What's happened?
What happened? Wall Street crash. The Wall Street crash, 1929. What happens is, whenever there's an economic crash, whatever government's in power is going to lose the next election. It doesn't matter what. And that's always the way it works. Well, except in Zimbabwe. I mean, where there's real elections. Herbert Hoover was elected president of the United States of America in 1928. But in those days, you became president in March the next year. It took longer around the country, of course, communications. So he was elected in 1928. March 1929, he's president of the United States. Wall Street crash happens in the week he becomes president. Of course, gets blamed on him because, I mean, how can you be to blame if you just came into the office that day? Besides, presidents don't actually choose economies. Economic movements is by forces outside of any president's hands. Well, unless you run a pose and want expropriation without compensation or like Mugabe. But normally it's outside, certainly a free president wouldn't interfere with the way an economy works. But still, he was destroyed by that. And the media was, this was all part of a campaign to get the Republicans out, get Democrats back in. Of course, Democrats always get you into another war. And there's no better way to run up debt and to distract people than through war. So that's what changed. The Americans, you got to remember your lesson. Because, for example, you just think, you can remember it. September the 11th, 2001, after the World Trade Center. What was it? Well, Islam's finished now. I mean, Americans are really going to have backlash. But within just 8 years, you had Obama in? 7 years. Barack Hussein Obama, a covert Muslim, gets into the White House and makes America the biggest laughingstock and disgrace in the whole world. Destroys Christianity in the Middle East in so many ways. Causes havoc, bringing down Libya, trying to start this war in Syria, and all the hideous things, the chaos in Egypt. So, in 7 years, the Americans went from being, well, Islam's the greatest threat to world peace, to being, we've got to have one in the White House. So, unfortunately, people's memories are a bit slow, but also, of course, the media's to blame. And but the Wall Street crash was so disastrous, and people are so tens of millions lost their homes, lost their farms, lost everything. And in that situation, that's when social engineers can do their work. Chaos. And it took a lifetime of study for Herbert Hoover to work out what on earth happened and why. So I mean that's the backstory.
And he also wasn't a career politician.
No, not even close. Yeah. He, in fact, spent his life saving people. He is the great humanitarian. He won Nobel Prizes for this. He is credited with saving the people of Belgium in the First World War, getting the people in Finland spared. When Finland was being attacked by the Soviets, he was mobilizing humanitarian aid. So he's the great humanitarian. He's the son of a Quaker. So he came from a pacifist background. He wasn't a pacifist, but his family upbringing was very pacifist. But he obviously did not believe in foreign adventurism. You defend your country, you don't attack others. And of course, I mean, when was America attacked? But they've sure attacked a lot of other countries. When I go to America, often if people say, you know, the reason why the Muslims hate us is because we're free. So that's rubbish. They hate you because you bomb them. Nobody hates Switzerland. Switzerland's free. They're freer than you. They've been free longer than anyone else. But nobody hates Switzerland because Switzerland minds their own business. And the only thing they do for the rest of the world is the Red Cross and so on. They make nice chocolates and cheese. And great watches. Switzerland's free. Nobody hates them for being free. People hate you because you bomb them and sanction them and cause no end of grief. Just mind your own business and pull your soldiers home and maybe people won't hate you so much. But the Americans are absolutely blind to the fact that, well, we've got to be the policemen of the world. Why? Well, you know, there's countries like Iran and North Korea. Yes, well, who made them that way?
So are you going to do a presentation about 9/11 as well? Because it's pretty much exactly the same story.
No jokes. Yeah, well, actually, I don't need to. There's some very good films that have been made on it, some very, very, very good films. For example, I mean, you just have to look into 9/11 things. For example, you can see aircraft flying, obviously badly, and hitting a telephone pole made of wood. And the telephone pole shaves off the wing. I mean, aluminium does not win a battle against even wood. But now we believe that these aluminium planes just cut straight through reinforced concrete and steel. Steel pillars. You can even just Google what Donald Trump said. He said, "I build buildings." And let me tell you, the World Trade Center was really strongly built. They didn't just have the iron on the center, they had it on the exterior. Very, very, very strong. Said no plane could possibly cut through steel pillars and reinforce. He said that's the strongest kind of building possible. It's like, it doesn't matter how fast you fling the butter at the knife will win.
Yeah, actually, I heard in primary school, long before it happened, that's where I learned the World Trade Center buildings were designed to take multiple hits of airplanes.
Yes.
And then when I saw it happen, I saw the buildings fall, and I thought, well, something's not right there.
But the camera never lies.
Yeah, well, the camera told a lot of truth. It's just the way it fell. I've just said, that's not a building falling over, that's a building being demolished.
That's imploding.
That's obvious. Yes. Otherwise, it would have just toppled instead of falling on itself.
But you know, the camera never lies. And there's this galaxy far, far away, long, long ago, Star Wars, you know? I mean, you've seen it with the eyes, so you know it's true. I mean, it couldn't be fake, could it? Yes, well.
They share money or something when they have visited the country to government?
I think it's more than that. Doubtless money is part of it, because of course there's the bankers making a lot of money, there's the military industrial complex making a lot of money. You can imagine, when everyone minds their own business and gets on with things, it enriches the average person. But when there's wars and chaos, well then military industrial complex and the pharmaceutical companies make a mint. And of course the banks who lend the money for people to pay for it, and then the poor taxpayers got to pay for this for the next few generations. Well, they're the suckers. But just think, for example, America's mining its own business in 2001, when World Trade Center was attacked. And, you know, Cold War's over. No, there's only one world superpower. No more nuclear threat. I mean, we can actually get on with business. And there was a moment that was nice. Berlin Wall's fallen. Soviet Union's fallen. Cold War's over. And so everything, actually, there was just a moment of a bit of stability. But when that happened, well, we got to do something. Next thing, they're attacking Afghanistan, then they're attacking Iraq. Now, how many Muslim terrorist attacks were there on America before that? Well, there's been tens of thousands of Muslim terrorist attacks around the world since. It's like they opened up a hornet's nest. And, of course, this enabled the Muslims to recruit people because America's invading our countries. The Christian crusaders are invading our countries. So you managed to radicalize the people in the Muslim Middle East, and suddenly, where things have been quite stable, like Syria and Iraq, turned into chaos. Libya, nobody was fleeing from Libya. Libya had a higher standard of living than most other countries. It was a very stable country. But by the destruction of the people, by the millions are fleeing from these countries in Europe, creating tsunamis of chaos and destabilization, a tsunami of refugees, actually. But it ruins the lives of a few million people, destroys many countries, as has been done by decolonization, chaos, and communist revolutions all over Africa. But some people are making amends. And the leaders, well, they get doubtless a lot of kickbacks and benefits, but also they've become a war hero. There are a lot of people who think Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a great hero. Of course, I'm not one of them. But, yes, and I'm afraid that these people who've done these things for different reasons, they're obviously, they've benefited somehow. But it's been at the expense of the general population.
And also, doesn't communism have a global agenda? Like
Oh, well, of course. So, I mean, look, America was a God-fearing, mostly Protestant country where people were mostly farmers, hardworking mom-and-pop shops and farms. But The Wall Street crash bankrupted so many of these people. Tens of millions of people lost their homes, their farms, their savings, their pensions, their everything. And of course, the 2008 selling of worthless derivatives bubble crashing, that also cost tens of millions of people their homes, their jobs, their pensions, savings, and everything else. And but that's the sort of destabilization they like. You think of how stable Congo used to be, or Rhodesia, and then the chaos caused. And of course, for the people concerned, this is a catastrophe. But for some people up top, they're really benefiting from all this destabilization. And they need to destabilize countries to get away with the nonsense they're doing, because normal people in a normal peaceful situation would not go for that. I mean, you just think how stable was South Africa before the Anglo-Boer War. Why did they do that? Why did they need to have the expropriation of compensations in Zimbabwe? Things were too stable. Chaos is one of the goals of the communists. In fact, remember, if you believe in evolution, evolution leads to revolution, quotes unquote from Stalin. Because there was this big explosion, and out of that came everything. So once upon a time there was nothing, and then there was something, and something became everything. And so, to quote Lenin now, never underestimate the value of constructive chaos. Because they believe everything in the world came about through an explosion, so if you can just burn down enough things and blow up enough things, then utopia will arise. This is social Darwinism, cultural Marxism. Create chaos, it'll create paradise. If that makes sense to anybody, but if you're on drugs or if you're communist, it'll make sense. Yeah.
I remember one day we were sharing the gospel in Burka with American Daniel De Villiers, and the Muslim asked, "Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from the Americas." America, the biggest terrorist on the planet, they just bomb all our countries. So the Muslims hate America.
And you know, I begin to understand why. Because I used to think that America was totally justified in everyone they bombed. You know, you've got to liberate countries by flying B-52s and dropping tons of bombs on people. This is how you liberate people. But it doesn't make any sense. I mean, why would you want that? If, you know, we want to liberate you in Cape Town. Let's have 1,000 bomber saturation raids, strategic bombing over this place. And then when you're all bombed to pieces and you've lost many of your loved ones and you've lost everything that you had, then now you're free. Oh, thank you so much. You know, I feel so much better now. Like democracy coming soon to a place near you, and here's some cruise missile coming down there. So the Americans, most Americans that I speak to are absolutely convinced that the world would be a terrible place if America wasn't bombing everybody. I mean, they somehow are keeping everything together by just bombing more countries. And I challenge my American friends, tell me one war that the United States has been involved in the 20th century that made the world a better place. Just one. And the only answer I had from one person was, well, maybe President Reagan invading Grenada? Okay, I'll give you Grenada, fair enough. 1980, what was that, 81 or something? They took Grenada, a little island that the Cubans were turning into a little terrorist place. And okay, so that they improved life in Grenada. Next?
What about their civil war and then the results in liberating slavery?
Well, everyone else managed to end slavery without a war.
Yeah.
The British did it years before without anybody having to be killed. Well, except the slave raiders. they made them walk the plank and so on. But nobody died in England from a civil war to end. So everyone ended the slave trade. The whole of Europe ended slavery without a war. So why did America need a war? Well, it wasn't about slavery. It's about state rights. You take, for example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Sorry. You take, for example, Abraham Lincoln's speech, Gettysburg Address. That government of the people, for the people, of the people, shall not perish. You'd swear that the U.S. Union forces were fighting for self-determination of peoples. But no, that's what the Confederates were fighting for. They were fighting for government of the people, by the people, for the people. His troops, the Bluecoats, they were fighting to take back land that had seceded and declared independence from them. They didn't want people to rule themselves. So the American war between states was not for the principles espoused in the Gettysburg Address. That was propaganda. I mean, that speech was appropriate for the Confederates. It wasn't appropriate for the Yankees. He was locking up people. He locked up Supreme Court justices. He locked up the entire Maryland legislature because they would want to secede, and so wouldn't let them gather together to secede. He deprived tens of thousands of people of their freedom of movement, freedom of speech, freedom of everything. He banned, blockaded, murdered, hung. The biggest mass hanging in history was done by Abraham Lincoln. There's something, it was 300 and something Indians hung at one time at one place on, under his orders. He was not exactly a the way they depict him. So, yes, I think our history really needs to be rewritten, and we need a whole new series of films that would... Imagine if we took some of the intrigues that we've mentioned here. It makes some of the intrigues they make in the average films entertaining. Reality is actually more fascinating than any fiction.